For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a community of people seeking to live our lives in the orienting center of God's love in the midst of our post-Christian world, learning to lead like Jesus, live on mission, and make disciples. In nature, gravity is the phenomenon that brings stuff together, objects as small as atoms and quarks and as large as stars and galaxies. We believe the gravity of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ. The Gravity Leadership Podcast is curated conversations on what it looks like to practically orient our lives and our leadership in the love of Christ, the gravity that holds everything together. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks, Ben.
And we're live.
And go. Hey, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. This is Matt Tebbe. I'm one of the co-founders of Gravity Leadership. I'm here with my friend, church planter, and co-founder, Ben Sternke.
Hello.
And we are here with our friend, Brian Zond. Brian's a pastor at Word of Life Church in St. Louis, Missouri. We've talked with him.
St. Joseph, Missouri.
Did I say St. Louis?
You did.
The other saint.
Yeah, we're sensitive to that mistake that happens to us all the time because we're just this little podunk thing that gets overlooked.
St. Jose, Missouri. St. Joseph, Missouri. Sorry. And maybe I should stop introducing him. Let him introduce himself. Welcome, Brian, to back to the podcast.
Thank you. Yep. Good to be with you.
You are doing these prayer schools. We've talked about those. You also are hosting something this summer called the Water to Wine Gathering. Am I getting that right? Can you give us a brief description of why you're hosting a Water to Wine gathering and what it's about?
Yeah, it's very simple. And in many ways, it's similar to why I do prayer schools. It came about in that same way. I wrote a book. When did I write it? I got it right here. 2016 is the copyright. Water to Wine, Some of My Story. And it's I guess, I don't know what it is. Is it a theological memoir? Is it something like that? It's the story of a pastor who goes through a very dramatic shift in his theology. I mean, it's my story. And I tell that story and kind of unpack what changed and make my case for it. And that book has been very well received. Sometimes people think of me maybe as controversial. I don't know. I mean, because sometimes, you know, I challenge traditional assumptions, maybe about atonement theology or some other aspects. But this book gets no critique. I mean, nobody dislikes it because it's a memoir. It's my story. So it's, what are you going to do? Argue with me about my story? It's my story. But it's the book that has generated, I think, probably by far the most personal messages sent to me. You know, they'll find me. You know, if you want to talk to me, you'll find me. And people find out how to get an email or a Facebook message or something to me. And I get them, I'm probably not exaggerating if I say probably every day. Wow. From pastors. I come from pastors who are on the verge, maybe right in the middle, maybe just starting their own theological shift. And they're terrified. They're afraid maybe they'll lose their faith, although that's usually not the case. They're usually more afraid of, can I continue to pastor this particular local congregation? What is the board going to say? What is my bishop, the supervisor, whatever hierarchy they have, perhaps in their denomination? What are they going to say? And they feel very alone. And they just want me to know that my book helped them. And then they'll ask me some questions. And so I respond to all these I can. And then quite a few people will come see me. I mean, they will ask, can I come see you? I say, yeah, you can come see me. And, you know, they could come from anywhere. I mean, they might just be, you know, an hour away, but usually they're, you know, from Dallas or wherever, you know, they're from anywhere. And And this has been going on for a couple of years now, where if I'm in town almost every week, I'm meeting someone that's come, you know, a great effort to come see me. And I'm thinking, well, instead of meeting with these guys one at a time, what if I did something so that a bunch of people could come at the same time and they could also meet one another? And because, you know, in this age we live in, you can have really good friendships with people that are on, you know, the other side of the country. I mean, a couple of my best friends live in Denver and Abbotsford, British Columbia, and I communicate with them every day. So maybe maybe some people will meet and they'll form friendships. Now, this isn't a pastor's guy. Anybody can come, but I do know that it'll be probably disproportionately represented by pastors and Christian leaders. That's what it is to kind of unpack that, talk about that. And I've invited some other people. This wasn't like, okay, I'm going to have a conference and what big speakers can I get? These are people that have actually gone through. Well, I just mentioned without even being aware of it. I talked about my two good friends in Denver and Abbotsford. That's Joe Beach, pastor of Amazing Grace Church in Denver, and Brad Jerzak, Orthodox theologian in Abbotsford, British Columbia. And they were with me. I mean, we walked through this together. That's one of the great saving grace. And my wife. And my wife will be speaking. And so we're going to talk about, you know, what it looks like to take a church or just as a Christian, your own journey to leave some of the certitudes that had been perhaps assumptions that had been given to you to begin to rethink some of those things. Now I feel like I'm just rambling. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and it felt like Water of the Wine was sort of your book of your journey in that, and you had definitive artifacts, like little guideposts that signified those shifts. And then it feels to me, at least, like your latest book, Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God, is there are the particularities of the theology that maybe make up a lion's share of that shift. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you where that book came, because I have the, you know, there was a series of books that I didn't really intend as a trilogy, but they kind of worked together that way. Unconditional, a book on forgiveness. Beauty Will Save the World, which is understanding Christianity along with the good, the true. How about the beautiful? An aesthetic theology. And then A Farewell to Mars, which is my critique of complicity in war for Christians. Those three books then raised questions. People would say, yeah, but what about Old Testament violence? Mm. And what about the fear of God and the wrath of God? What about the cross? Isn't that God employing violence to some redemptive end? What about hell? My goodness, what about that? What about hell? How beautiful is that? What about hell? Yeah. And then what about the book of Revelation? And even though I don't specifically say so anywhere in Sinners in the Hands of the Loving God, it's really me addressing those questions. Wrath of God, fear of God, Old Testament violence. What about the cross? What about hell? What about Revelation? Okay. That's what it really is.
Whataboutism. Yeah. It's everywhere.
Yes, it is. I think a lot of our listeners will resonate with that. A lot of the people that we're involved with in our coaching and who listen to this podcast, I do think they've become disenchanted in some ways with, as you said, the certitudes that have been handed to us, these things that that we've been given that have said, like, this is absolutely true, this is how things are, just how it is. And they've begun to ask some questions about that. They either have, you know, some of those deep theological questions that you mentioned, or they just intuit this, that there's something off about this. This isn't working kind of for them anymore. It's not helping them become more like Jesus.
I think most readers that come to Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God, most of them are sympathetic readers. And they've reached probably a place where they want to believe that God is not ontologically angry, violent, and retributive. But they still have high regard for the scriptures. And so they're intuiting, I think it might be true that God is not ontologically angry, violent, and retributive. But what about these texts? And so I'm really speaking to that person, showing them there is a way to treat the scriptures very seriously and very respectfully, but not end up with some caricature of a chick track or Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which, by the way, this is not a polemic against Jonathan Edwards.
Sure.
Now, I hate that particular sermon he wrote, but hey, I hate some of my own sermons, you know. Sometimes sermons come. It's not my fault, though, that that sermon became the most influential sermon in American history. I don't think nothing has formed the American religious imagination more than that. Because America is a Puritan nation.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, atheists are Puritan atheists. I mean,
the God they don't believe in.
I mean, the God they don't believe in is the God of Puritanism. And so that's in our DNA. And Jonathan Edwards did a lot of things that are beautiful and wonderful. I think his essay on the Trinity is fabulous. I love that. But the fact of the matter is this sermon sort of just has lingered. It's stayed in the milieu of American religious imagination, and it's representative of something that is a default mode for a lot of people. And I think it needs to finally be dismantled
and
dismissed.
What is it about the American imagination that violence and retribution appeal so much to it?
Well, we are a violent people. Now, I suppose, you know, most nations, I don't know. We are a nation of conquest. You know, the older European nations could become horribly violent, but they could account for their own existence without a violent narrative, because they're the emergence of their own ethnicity or whatever, just lost in the mist of history. Americans are a nation that has been achieved through conquest and violence. And then we have to try to redeem that with redemptive myth. And so, you know, what is more quintessentially American than the American cowboy? Dispensing justice, by which we mean vengeance and retribution, through his six shooter. And that is deep in the psyche of Americans, and it's hallowed, it's revered, and it's a lie, and it's false, and it's contrary to the way of Christ, and it needs to be deconstructed.
Yeah,
but it's hard. As I travel the world, and I travel a lot now internationally because I can and I like to. That's when I do that. And
so there.
But as I have conversations with thoughtful Christians in other lands, the two questions that always come up, they're the two that always come up when they get comfortable with me and we're just sitting around talking, they'll go, well, what is it with, how come you guys don't, your healthcare thing doesn't make any sense to me. That's the second thing though. The most common though is, you guys are pretty crazy about your guns, aren't you? And you know, Australians and people in New Zealand and Portugal and France and Switzerland and wherever else, they can't quite understand it. They're not attacking me. They're actually begging for me to help them understand. Yeah. And I don't know that I've ever succeeded in helping anybody understand. But it has to do with that, with our own creation myth of how America came to be. Violence is hallowed.
So if you take away violence, so the way myths work is the way we make sense of the world. We bring meaning and make sense of who we are and how we are in relationships through, you know, the noetic structure of myth. So I was struck just, you know, you deconstruct some notions of hell, you deconstruct some notions of violence, you deconstruct some notions of just a lot of things in the book. But what I was struck by is, the people who read your book and decided to write about it online and disagreed with you focused on one aspect of your book. you know which aspect I'm going to say, right?
Yeah.
What is it? What?
By the way, and it's not.
No,
hell.
It's not.
The hell chapter has been the chapter that people really have liked. And my wife, who is cautious, she's more cautious than I am, and she's sort of my ballast. And she's also she's a good editor. She's always my first editor. And when I write, if I spend a day writing, because I don't tend to write in little bits of time, I'll have days of writing. And when I get to the end of my day of writing, the first thing I do is I take what I've written and Perry reads it back to me aloud, offering suggestions. And we work on it for a couple of hours that way. And when I finally had finished that chapter 6, Hell and How to Get There, she said, this chapter will not cause you any trouble. And it hasn't.
Too bad your name's not Rob Bell, because then it would have.
So what was, just for the listeners who aren't maybe aware of it, like what one aspect are you talking about? What gave him so much trouble?
His love of Bob Dylan. People cannot, some people can't stand Bob Dylan and they let him know about it all the time. The one aspect is like you can go after sort of eternal conscious torment. You can go after all these other things. But if you go after my atonement theory, Brian, you take violence out of the Godhead, now you're going to be called a heretic.
I do get called a heretic, and I'm not.
Yeah, but you know that nothing arouses the ire.
Well, okay, yeah.
You know, if you push back against certain understandings of penal substitutionary atonement, people lose their biscuits on you.
Very.
Yeah.
Because it has become the gospel for a certain segment of evangelicals in America. By the way, this is also the subject that gets me the most invitation to seminaries. And which I like, you know, I mean, I get a lot of invitations to speak on atonement theology in seminaries these days.
That's a good sign. Seems like a good sign.
Not Calvin College yet, but you know.
Just the heretical ones, right? Is that what you're saying?
Here's the thing. It's penal substitutionary atonement theory. Right. There are numerous theories about how we understand the cross as salvific, as saving us, as redemptive. This is a theory. You know, I know some people are going to dispute this, but it comes into its present form through Calvin via Anselm. But it comes into its present form with Calvin. So even if it's true, I don't think it is, it's new. The church was well able for centuries, millennia actually, to understand the cross, or not understand the cross, talk about the cross, speak of the cross as saving without having to resort to a penal substitutionary atonement theory. The Orthodox Church, you know, the whole Eastern side of Christianity, has never embraced it. I mean, and now, you know, somebody asked me the other day, is it true that the early church called PSA heresy? I said, no, they'd never heard of it.
Right.
I mean, it's not going to come about for about 1,500 years. Now the Orthodox Church is very aware of it, and they very, very deliberately, very self-consciously say, no, that is not how we speak of the cross. That's not how we understand it. I think that it has something to do, Anselm working from the feudal honor code, and then it gets picked up by Calvin, who was a lawyer. I can pick on lawyers. My dad was a judge, and my brother's a lawyer, and my cousins and uncles are lawyers. So some people were raised by wolves. I was raised by lawyers, so it's all right. But there is something about a lawyer who is going to see the cross, as primarily a way that we are rescued from punishment, but in the most ugly fashion, the idea that God has to satisfy justice by pouring his wrath out upon his son. Now, the moment you say, though, that God has to satisfy justice, it's like, oh, hold on. Right. You just said God has to do
and something. Who's this justice fellow?
Yeah. Who's in charge here? You know, I thought that this, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God that Jesus called Father, Abba, was, you know, the top. But apparently, Lady Justice is hovering off on the wings somewhere, and that Jehovah is beholden to her, so that he would say, I'd like to forgive y'all, but I gotta satisfy.
But this lady over here, you know how she gets.
She's gonna require blood.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how much. I mean, you know, I've written on it, and we can go into
it. Well, it's been very helpful.
Maybe you should ask a specific
question. Yeah, it's been very helpful.
But here's the problem. Here's the problem. If PSA, I usually don't like to call it PSA because that sounds too nice. I like to say penal substitutionary atonement theory. I did an academic debate where the whole time I never would say PSA. I always said penal substitutionary atonement theory. This makes it sound so absurd, but if PSA is the gospel, I don't think it is, but if it is, well, then they never preach the gospel in the book of Acts.
Right.
The gospel is the story of Jesus. It's not an atonement theory. Whatever atonement theories you have, that's not the gospel is the story of Jesus and his becoming king. That's the gospel. So, and heresy, you know, that's a heresy. Heresy. I mean, I've had plenty of Orthodox theologians and priests and bishops tell me that PSA is heresy. I said, well, you know, I just don't care to play that game. But I mean, you get both sides throwing this. Heresy traditionally, historically, has to do with a misunderstanding or misrepresentation of the nature of Christ. Okay. That's really where that term is most often applied and probably most accurately applied. When people call me a heretic, I usually just recite the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed and say, I'm not a heretic. I just disagree with your atonement theory. But it is, So for whatever reason, Americans are very susceptible to the idea that justice must be satisfied through violent retribution. Mm-hmm. And I think that is projection of the worst kind.
Yeah.
That it is not God who requires violent retribution as a form of justice. That's we're the ones that have
I think and that's why some of your writings and others, of course, have been really helpful for me and for a lot of the people that listen to this podcast, because they have these intuitions. And it's helpful to hear some of those things to think, okay, that's right. It's not the gospel. I'm not a heretic if I have questions about this, that I can, you know. So theologically, it's been helpful for people. A lot of the people that listen to us and a lot of people that we coach are in pastoral ministry. They are vocational, you know, ministers, or they lead in the church in some way. What was it? I have two questions. What was it like for you as you made this theological transition, but then also had to interface with your church, who was presumably not going on the same theological journey at the same pace as you? What was that journey like for you? And then what advice would you give to a pastor or a leader in a church who feels like, I can't talk about any of this stuff? Like, how do I process that? How do I move forward in my leadership if I'm having these questions, but I'm worried about how my church is going to respond to me?
Let me say this first of all. This is a minor point, but I never have had any pushback on specifically on PSA in my own local church. First of all, I've never used the term penal substitutionary atonement theory in the pulpit. Yeah. I've never, but what I have done is sort of give versions of that model and then shown why I think it's not compatible with the God revealed in Christ. And people are like, praise God. Where I did get pushback was with eschatology, because you know, the whole late great planet Earth left behind dispensational rapturism stuff is deeply ingrained in people. And that's hard. That was a hard one to pull back from. And it happens to be the one area when people say in an accusatory voice, you've changed your theology. You've changed. I would always say, let's say I nuanced, I matured, I adapted. With one exception, when it comes to eschatology, I just have to say, "Yep,
got me."
And I changed it because it was wrong. And my only defense, if I need to defend myself, I'll just say,
"But
yeah,
I didn't invent dispensationalism. I inherited it. It took me a while to figure out that it's wrong. But you know, let's just say, thank God for N.T. Wright,
yes,
who has, you know." Done a lot to help us, but I don't think he's done. I can't see him doing any more than he's done. His biggest contribution is to rescue the American church from terrible eschatology if it wants to be rescued. If you're just determined to hold on to that ugly version then I don't know what I can do for you. Probably the book at one point anyway, I don't know if it's true today, maybe. The book I've recommended the most to pastors, other than my own, is N.T. Wright's Surprised by Hope. I don't know that it's – Tom Wright doesn't probably know how to write at a truly pew level, at a layman level. He thinks he does, but it's like, no, you're like living in St. Andrews and Anna. Right. Cambridge and freaking Oxford, you know. These are not the people that I pastor. And so we need – I remember – I just heard just yesterday. I remember reading that book whenever it came out, 2011 maybe. I don't know when it was. Nine, I don't know. And I don't think I've ever done this where I just – okay, I'm just going to make a sermon series out of this book. And I remember I called it Hope, Heaven, and Resurrection. And man, people loved that. Some didn't love it. Some didn't love it. But most, those that loved it really loved it. And someone just told me yesterday, you know, they were a college student at that time. And they said, that saved Christianity for me. I mean, I was on a trajectory. I was just done with all this ugly eschatology. And I was going to move. I know I was fated to just leave Christianity. And I came to your church and heard that series. And it saved Christianity for me.
Yeah.
So how to take a church? Well, you take a church through it slowly. Sunday morning is not a time to be confrontational. Sometimes you just present. Say, you don't always have to state the other side. You don't always have to bash the opposition. You just begin to preach something better. There's almost a kind of, I don't mean to be disingenuous, but there's a time that you can kind of play dumb where you can, as a pastor, sort of like pretend that you don't know the other arguments. And you preach something new and fresh and life-giving. And if people are going to make significant theological transitions, they have to connect the dots themselves. You can't just bully them into it.
Yeah.
You can't tell them, okay, you were believing all this, and that's just stupid, so quit that and straighten them. Now believe this. That won't work. So you draw the dots pretty close, but you still let them connect. Now, I found there's three things. Some people never connect the dots. Okay. Some people connect the dots and go, oh, is that what you're saying? I'm out of here. But other people connect the dots and go, oh, that's beautiful. And they stay on the journey. And but it is an art. You have to be patient. Sometimes I feel like, you know, maybe did I move too fast? And then I look back and say, it took me 10 years.
Wow.
It took me 10 years. Now, I was in the advantageous position of being a pastor who could at least attempt that. In other words, being the founding pastor of a non-denominational church, which I, by the way, don't even believe in.
But here you are.
Yeah.
I'm playing the cards that were dealt me, you know. It did afford me the opportunity to attempt it because I wasn't going to be fired. I wasn't going to be fired by a board or an elder or a bishop or a hierarchy. Now, I could be left, you know, and there was always that fear that everybody would leave and I'd be left with the mortgage.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, a very real fear. But at least I could attempt it. And so not every pastor is in that position. You know, the moment, you know, did you hear Pastor Bob doesn't believe in the rapture? You know, that could be, you know, 6 weeks from being terminated.
Yep. I just want to reflect back what I heard because I think this is encouraging. You proclaim good news. You let people move at their own pace. And I just hear like patience, like it's slow and difficult to transition like the theological framing and focus of a church. I mean, I often tell people who are trying to disciple people locally, it took Jesus 3 years and his success rate wasn't all that great. Like he called 12, one fell away, four guys we never hear from again. And there's you know, a bunch of people that are doubting on a mountain when he commissions them. And you know, if Brian Zahn takes 10 years to transition his church, like maybe you can't do this in a summer sermon series. Right. Like, you know,
you cannot, and don't try, and don't think that that's going to happen. Don't set that as a goal. Just don't. And you don't have to preach every, I warn pastors, don't preach on the cutting edge of your own personal theological discoveries.
Can you say more about that? Yeah. Say more about that.
Well, keep two things separate. There is your pastoral preaching life. Okay. That's this life. And then there is the life where you're reading whatever. You're reading Karl Barth, or you're reading something from, you know, somebody, you know, edgy and heterodox, like John Dominique Crossan, who, you know, but don't you know, start reading Crossan and Borg and then say, you know, start preaching that week later.
Yeah.
Keep those two things separate, and preach from something that is, that you've worked into your own life over a period of time, and you're confident you can speak from that. So there's what I'm reading. And I say that because early on, around 2006, I was making that mistake. And that's something I regret, that I was using my pulpit for my own theological experimentation. I was thinking out loud in the pulpit. I was working my theology out in the pulpit.
Yeah, working out your life.
Work out in your life, and then you probably also need a cadre of theological buttons that are safe, that aren't going to, you know, drop an H-bomb on you and call you a heretic, and that are well-read and that are, you know, with you and bounce things off. Because you probably do need an outlet. Right. And if you don't have an outlet, you'll make your pulpit the outlet, and it shouldn't be that. So you need some... There'll probably be other pastors, but they could be, you know, really well-read laymen, but probably more likely they're going to be pastors that you get together with every Thursday morning for breakfast and discuss the latest, you know, Power Wasp book or whatever.
That's really helpful.
Really, really helpful. Yeah. I'm reminded of advice. I may have even said it on this podcast before, but advice that Dallas Willard gave at a conference that I was at. Somebody was asking a similar question, you know, like, because Dallas Willard had this vision of the kingdom of God, you know, like the gospel is the proclamation of the kingdom of God, the availability of the kingdom.
Dallas Willard was my gateway drug.
Mine too. And he gave this advice. He said, I think the parable of the soils was given to Christian ministers because he said the thing to do is to get up in your pulpit and to proclaim the availability of the kingdom. And that's what you do. And then he said, some people will, you know, there's different soils. Some people will look at you and say, you know, I think that's wrong, and I'm a little bit concerned about you. And he says, that's okay. You take that with patience. Some people will just fall asleep like they normally do during your sermons. And he said, but other people will say, I knew it. I knew there had to be more. And he said, gather those people into groups and work with them. I mean, he had a way of saying things.
Well, Brian, thanks for being with us today. I just got to tell you, just personally, as a pastor, I can think of three friends who have either called me or texted me in tears of joy reading your book, reading Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God, that it's just given them permission. It's given them permission to move forward in their faith in a way that felt dangerous or scary or wrong to them. So thank you for the pastoring you're doing through your books.
Thank you for telling me
and
that.
I mean, this is Todd, and it's Ignacio, and it's Andy. Like, they benefit so greatly from what you're doing. So thank you for your work. Thanks for spending some time with us today. And we'll see you at Prayer School and Water to Wine.
I'm looking forward to seeing you next month.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Brian. So we talked about this Water to Wine gathering a little bit with Brian on this episode. This is a gathering in St. Joseph, Missouri at Brian's church. And we get all the time people who come into Gravity Leadership seem to be kind of on the same journey that Brian has narrated, this journey out of an Americanized...
weaponized?
Yeah, I mean, just
we've done several podcast episodes about what it is this transition is about.
But you, like,
all of our axioms are about this.
Yeah. Like, so if you really connect with our axioms, we've heard from people that you're like shouting in your car as you're listening. Yes. Like, if that's you, these axioms are meant to describe and name this shift. Anyway, this is a gathering, June 28th through 30th. You can go to watertowinegathering.com. You can also look in the show notes.
Yep.
There's a link there. Ben and I are trying to figure out a way to go.
We're trying to figure it out. If anybody wants to contribute to our fund,
we can sell plasma. I mean, there's got to be a way. Anyway, we're hoping to go. We hope that you're able to make it. But it'll be a good time to sort of look at other people in the face, in the eyes, who are on this same journey you are, to once again hear from the Lord and other people, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
God is at work, right? God is love, right?
Yeah.
And there's no unloveliness in him at all. Mm-hmm. And just worship and be with other people other people on this journey too. So we hope you can join us at that.
Yeah, and we hope we can join you as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you come, we should have a glass of wine.
Yeah.
If you partake in such...
Right. I mean, the name of the gathering is Water to Wine.
Yeah, so maybe some of you can have water. I'll be having wine.
Yes.
Hope to see you there.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you found it helpful, please let us know by leaving a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you review podcasts. You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com to ask a question or suggest a topic for a future episode. And join our online community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles that we found interesting or helpful in our work as local pastors and practitioners of discipleship and mission. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.